there ought to be a penalty or punishment for breaching confidentiality in this way.
Lieutenant Governor Sean Parnell wants new tools for stopping leaks on ethics complaints. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 23rd of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the city of Anchorage struggles to balance its books.
It's actually fairly dramatic, and I think we probably are looking at some personnel cuts. I don't know that there's any other way to achieve it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Lieutenant Governor Sean Parnell is asking Alaska's Attorney General to recommend ways to ensure state ethics probes remain confidential before they are complete. This week, a report by an independent investigator on an ethics complaint against Governor Sarah Palin was leaked to the Associated Press. The report was supposed to remain private until the investigation was finished and the governor decided to release it. Parnell says the executive branch needs to be accountable, but the ethics laws are being abused.
Take, for instance, if you walked into a jury room before a trial was over, took some papers out of that jury room, published them on the internet and in the press, most citizens would be up in arms about that. They would say that is it destroys due process, it destroys reputations, and it destroys our ability as a people to be free.
The investigator found there is probable cause that Governor Palin's endorsement of her legal defense fund violated state ethics rules. Palin and her lawyer have said the matter is still pending. The governor cited the numerous ethics complaints against her as one reason she is stepping down on Sunday in Fairbanks. Parnell will take the oath of office that day. He doesn't yet have a detailed legislative agenda, but he says he's focused on Alaska's families and the economy. And like Palin, he is a fiscal conservative.
These are times when we will judiciously use our savings, but we're also going to ensure that government doesn't grow, you know, by leaps and bounds. This is really a time when we need to live within our means as a state government, not draw more taxes from our people, and create that stable investment climate where jobs can be created here.
Parnell says he expects his transition to leading the state will be a smooth one.
Our constitutional founders were pretty smart about setting up the lines of succession. I knew when I ran for lieutenant governor that this was a possibility. We've prepared for the possibility. Didn't plan it happening this way, but we have so far had a really stable and smooth transition, and we've got a great team in place to meet Alaskans' needs.
Parnell will begin moving into the Anchorage governor's office on Monday. Anchorage is facing a considerable budget shortfall this year and next. The city is $9 million short this year and nearly double that amount next year. Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan announced the figures when he released his transition report today. Mayor Sullivan, why is Anchorage facing such a large budget shortfall?
Well, it happens when your revenues and your expenditures don't match up. And the primary drivers of that on the revenue side is we're not experiencing the anticipated numbers from things like bed tax and our investment funds, fees and fines are down, all those things that contribute to our overall revenue structure other than property tax. We're just not seeing the numbers that were projected. And then you combine that on the expenditure side with increased expenses, particularly in the labor contracts. And what we have is a budget challenge. And the $17 million challenge that was the first of the year, which they took care of, just was not adequate to take care of the whole problem. And with the city budget, we're required by law to balance the budget. So we definitely have to come up with $9 million in savings. We cannot go into deficit.
And what measures will you take to try to close the gap?
You know, you look at everything. First and foremost, we've asked all the executives in the city to take a 5% pay cut. We've put a hiring freeze on. We've put a travel freeze on. We're looking now then to each department. We had a meeting with all the department heads this morning, and we're going to be meeting with them one-on-one, going through their budget in detail, and literally finding ways that we can reduce costs and somehow maintain an adequate level of service.
Mayor, do you think that money from the Federal Economic Stimulus Act will help?
Probably not. We've gone through the stimulus package, and it looks like most of those funds are targeted to specific programs, oftentimes not programs that can replace general fund revenue. So it doesn't look like that's going to be a source. We probably, for next year, though, will be seeing if we can work with both our state and federal governments and maybe get some help on funding some programs that normally come from the operating budget and the general fund, and seeing if we can't get some grants to help offset some of that. And with the state, maybe an increase in revenue sharing.
You mentioned a hiring freeze and possible pay cuts. Do you expect that you're going to be losing some city jobs as well?
Well, not possible pay cuts. All the executives in the city, which is over 150, are getting pay cuts, and the hiring freeze is in effect. But in order to come up with $9 million, keep in mind that one of the challenges is that $9 million has to happen over just the last 5 months of the year. So it's actually fairly dramatic, and I think we probably are looking at some personnel cuts. I don't know that there's any other way to achieve it, to be honest with you.
Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan. As Congress grapples with the enormous task of trying to overhaul the healthcare system, Alaska's seniors are getting a 1-2 punch from Medicare and Medicaid. The latest problem is within the Medicaid waiver program that has caused federal managers to put a halt to the state enrolling or even paying for approved potential Medicaid clients that are caught on a waiting list. This, in addition to seniors finding few options available to them in a state with a dwindling supply of doctors who are willing to take Medicare patients. Anchorage resident Danya Clemens has been in Alaska for more than 3 decades. Clemens is the chair of the Senior Citizens Advisory Commission. She says when she turned 65, before she retired and still had health care coverage, she began to realize Medicare was going to be troublesome after visiting a clinic during a severe asthma attack.
Gasping for breath. And when I opened my wallet to give her my insurance card, she happened to see my Medicare card and said, "I'm sorry, we don't take Medicare." And I said, "But Medicare is not my first payee. It's, you know, my insurance from my work." And she said, "I'm sorry, even if it's the second payee, we just don't take Medicare." So the Medicare card has become a liability. You want to hide it when you go anywhere.
And after she retired, Clemens and her husband got a letter from their physician of 15 years saying he would no longer accept Medicare. He said he would keep them on, but they would have to pay cash for their visits.
But then, of course, every month they take out of our Social Security check the Medicare payments and then also our Medigap insurance with AARP. So it's not really cost-effective to pay for something when you can't get the service.
Clemens figured it would be easy to find another doctor.
I started calling, and everywhere I called, they said, "No, we're not taking new Medicare patients." I must have called over 60.
She finally had success with a doctor she'd seen years earlier who agreed to take them as patients once again, but only for about a year.
So came another letter. We were fired again.
Through her own research, she was pleasantly surprised to discover what she says is a clinic that not only offers excellent care, but welcomes Medicare patients.
Hi there. This is sort of where you sterilize your equipment, and then this is a little lab where they make...
Joan Fisher is the executive director of the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center. She says because ANHC gets federal funding, they can't refuse seniors on Medicare. Their mission is to serve the underserved.
And oddly, the Medicare population has become the new underserved, and they're not poor, not all of them. Some are, but it's... partly, you know, the healthcare system is broken. And so it's sad that our seniors, our pioneers, our the people that have been around the longest are now finding themselves without a primary care provider.
Community health centers have been around since the 1960s, when it became clear that doctors were vacating inner cities for the suburbs and low-income families were unable to find care. Federal funding assures the clinics are available to anyone, regardless of income or insurance, and Fisher says because of the Medicare crisis in Alaska, ANHC is cycling in about 33 new patients each month.
We're seeing a decrease in our uninsured, we're seeing a decrease in our Medicaid, we're seeing a decrease in our private insurance, and we're seeing an increase in Medicare.
The Medicare reimbursement rate is a complex formula, and according to an Institute of Social and Economic Research report, Medicare pays private doctors and ANHC the same rate for a short visit, but private doctors get more for longer visits. ANHC also does not get paid for providing medical service to people who are physically unable to come to the clinic. The Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center offers a full range of services, medical, dental, lab, and pharmacy in a one-stop setting. Dr. Tom Hunt is the medical director. Hunt says the healthcare industry needs to work on promoting preventative care rather than reactionary care. He says the clinic needs a mix of insured people along with uninsured or underinsured patients for them to survive.
And so if the economy continues to be challenging, if the Medicare crisis continues to ferment like it is, if more and more employers start knocking off health insurance, our payer mix will get more adverse. We'll see more newly uninsured, we'll see more underinsured, and we'll see more Medicare patients, which are effectively underinsured. And if we model that out, and we have, it's not a pretty trend.
The Neighborhood Health Center saw more than 10,500 patients last year, and Medicare patients represented about 18% of the patients they're seeing, but they represent a quarter of the visits because they often require more complex care. Because the clinic is geared toward patients who often have multiple health problems, Dr. Hunt says they can accommodate Medicare patients quite well, and they welcome them. He says the struggle for federal dollars is a perennial problem, but the importance of access to health care, not just for Medicare patients, but for everyone, is an investment in public safety. He says healthy communities are thriving communities. Tomorrow, we'll look at a new idea developing in Anchorage, a Medicare clinic modeled on the Neighborhood Health Center concept. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an unusual catch off Alaska's west coast.
The teeth, I thought they'd be a lot bigger or longer, but they were that long. But they were sharp, though.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. BP is focused on the future, getting more oil out of Prudhoe Bay and bringing Alaska's gas to North America.
The U.S. senator concerned about the fairness of Alaska Native Corporation's government contracts is holding off introducing an amendment that would give them more competition. Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill attached her amendment to a defense spending bill yesterday, but did not call it up for a vote today. Her office says she has not withdrawn the amendment. It's just on hold for now. Alaska Senator Mark Begich's spokeswoman Julie Haskett says Begich and McCaskill will work with the Native corporations on a more comprehensive reform package.
At the end of her hearing, she told the tribes, the Alaska Native corporations, that she would work with them, that she would leave the record open, that she would take more information, and let's work together, if you will, to make this better. So going ahead and filing an amendment so soon after that hearing seemed like she was going back on her word to a degree.
Senator McCaskill released a statement today saying reform is going to happen and that, quote, it's not a matter of if, but a matter of when. She said the process caused a slowdown but has not stopped her determination to, quote, restore competitiveness in government contracts. Alaska senators met today with the head of the Environmental Protection Agency to talk about the Kensington Mine project. They're upset that the EPA has asked for a re-evaluation of a permit, a move the senators say could stall the project. The mine north of Juneau has been on hold since 2006, while environmentalists and mining company Core Alaska battled in the courts over whether the mine could dump tailings into Lower Slate Lake. Last month, the U.S. Supreme Court sided with the mining company and decided a permit issued by the Army Corps of Engineers is valid. It looked like the project was set to go forward until last week. The EPA regional office in Seattle asked for a reevaluation of the permit. Now the Army Corps of Engineers has a 15-day public comment period open, but with further reevaluation, it could take months. Alaska senators summoned EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson to Senator Lisa Murkowski's office. Murkowski says their sit-down with Jackson was helpful.
It was clear that she didn't have all the facts. The letter that had come out from the Region 10 director, we believe, had some factual inaccuracies. We pointed those out. She indicated she would look at them.
Murkowski says EPA head Lisa Jackson did not indicate she's willing to pull back on the Region 10 request for the permit reevaluation. She says it's clear the EPA is dealing with this at its highest level because of the potential precedent. EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson would not comment after the meeting. Chum salmon are replacing Yukon kings as the main target for commercial fisheries on the Yukon River. The Yukon king used to be the base of the lower Yukon's economy, but dwindling king returns and tighter restrictions have commercial fishermen downgrading to chums. KYUK's Shane Iverson reports.
Yukon kings are among the most oil-rich salmon found in the world, but their numbers have been dwindling for years. Last year, they reached historic lows, and this year looks to be similarly poor. Meanwhile, over a million Yukon chum continue to run and return to the river to spawn. Jack Schulteis of Kwikpak Fisheries says his company began preparing years ago to adjust to the Yukon runs.
We were insightful enough to see this coming to where let's invest in chum marketing, and we worked really hard on those markets, invested a considerable amount of money into it.
Schulteis manages Kwikpak Fisheries. He's overseen operations at the processing plant in Imanok. Behind him, water is being pumped from a tender. It's the melt-off from ice keeping thousands of chum salmon fresh. Schulteis says the decision to focus on chums is a matter of simple math.
It was the issue that there was a lot more pounds of chums to sell than pounds of kings. And if you just fish kings, it's a two-week fishery and it's over with, where chums go all the way through the summer. I mean, we fish into September.
Kwikpak has operations in three lower Yukon villages. There have been seven commercial openings so far this season. Schulteis says they have purchased about 1 million pounds of chum. That's pumped about $500,000 into the local commercial fleet. Summer Yukon chum fetch 50 cents a pound. That's just 10% the price that king salmon would fetch on the Yukon. The last king-directed commercial opening was in 2007. At that time, fishermen were getting $5 per pound. For some commercial operations, though, the reduced prices have made operations economically unviable. Tim Andrew is the chairman of the Musakchutlik Native Corporation located in Marshall. They own a small processing plant, but this year it's dormant, and the tender rests high and dry. He says their inability to harvest kings is the cause of the plant's closure.
You know, it used to be profitable, but we just can't operate in this current environment where we're only provided chum.
Nick Andrew is the president of the Ochagamut Native Tribe. He says in past summers, Marshall would be humming with processing activity. He says commercial fishing was the bread and butter of Marshall's economy.
It's a short-term, fast cash fix, but that short-term, fast cash that becomes available pays for fuel, heating fuel, all the your credit obligations with the local stores. Families buy clothing for their children and themselves, and to save money to buy gas for the fall and winter subsistence activities.
Fishermen aren't the only ones making some cash on the commercial industry. Kwikpak alone provides employment to about 300 workers, most of which are Yukon locals. Jerome Williams is a 16-year-old from St. Mary's. He's one of many young workers earning upwards of $9 an hour.
I ain't complaining about it. They pay me.
The Lower Yukon is in the Wade-Hampton census area, which has by far the highest unemployment rate in the state. It's at almost 25%. As William gets ready for another round of fish cutting, he says he's looking forward to spending his money this winter.
It'll make it enough for what I want to get. Yeah.
What's that?
A snow machine. But after that, I don't know if it'll help me throughout the year.
Williams is working as a processor for the third year. Schulte says providing jobs is one reason to continue with the chum-directed fishery.
There's been commercial fishery here for close to 100 years. We're just trying to maintain that.
Commercial fishermen on the Lower Yukon can look forward to a small pay increase. Kwikpak will be paying 20 cents more for fall chum than for summer chum. That's 70 cents a pound. Schulte says fall chum are the oiliest and most flavorful chum in Alaska. Fall chum is sold primarily as a smoked product to Japanese markets, as well as whole food markets in Europe and the United States. Reporting for KYUK, I'm Shane Iverson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
The state is weighing how to move forward with an oil and gas risk assessment. The Palin administration project was initiated in 2007 in response to corrosion-caused spills at Prudhoe Bay, but a contractor-devised methodology is drawing criticism. Longtime industry analyst Richard Feinberg says 2 years and over $1 million have been spent on an unreliable, data-driven strategy.
They don't have access to the data they need to assure that it's real, and they don't have access to the facilities to see what condition they're in. And the project should be boots on the ground looking at the facilities, not streams of computer data somewhere.
Feinberg and others are also critical of the project's narrowed scope. Longtime Department of Environmental Conservation on-scene coordinator Ed Meggert says the entire focus is now on infrastructure components.
Initially, it had three elements. One was looking at the actual structure itself, the infrastructure, the physical side. Then it looked at the process safety. Okay, what sort of programs did the industry have in place to guarantee integrity? And the third was government oversight of that process. Somewhere along the line, the last two got taken out.
Meggert says that makes the assessment pretty much useless. State Project Manager Ira Rosen says analysis of industry and government oversight still fit into the assessment. He says the Department of Natural Resources is separately looking at government regulation, and industry oversight is indirectly incorporated into the state assessment.
As far as our project goes and the proposed methodology, those elements, that is, their internal management programs, processes, et cetera, are factored in as coefficients or elements to consider in the value of the risk, numerical value. What Dr. Feinberg and others are kind of suggesting is that oversight or lack of oversight is in itself an initiating event.
Rosen says the state has not renewed a contract with a Doyon subsidiary that developed the proposed methodology and will look for another company to take over. Fishermen in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta pull in all kinds of fish throughout the year from rivers and streams in the area and from the deep coastal waters on the Bering Sea. But recently, a halibut fisherman in Quinnahock was surprised to see a fish that he'd never seen before when he pulled in his line. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Ellis Criswell reports.
It was a nice calm day, about 20 miles from the coastal village of Quinnahock, when Adolph Pleasant and a companion were rod and reel fishing from a boat for halibut. Everything was pretty normal until Pleasant started pulling in his line and he found a large shark on the end of it. Pleasant says he didn't know he had a shark on the line until it was at the surface of the water. The fish was about 7 feet, 4 inches long. It was so big and heavy, two other men in another boat came over to help haul in the shark. Pleasant says he was surprised and excited at the time. The men were fishing in about 73 feet of water. One of the other men was Fritz Petluska of Eek.
It had no scales. It was heavy. I think it was over 5 feet. It had pretty good sized fins, and the head was pretty big, yeah, I'd say. But the teeth, I thought they'd be a lot bigger or longer, but they weren't that long. But they were sharp, though.
Petluska says the shark was gray with dark spots and the skin felt rough to the touch. Catching the fish on a line might have been a surprise to the Quinnahock fishers, but the salmon shark being in the area is normal, according to Robert Foy. He is a research professor stationed on Kodiak Island and is an expert on salmon shark. Although most of the salmon sharks in the Bering Sea are off of the edge of the Bering Sea shelf, close to the Pribilof Islands and along the slope, Foy says the fish tend to follow salmon into the local streams this time of the year.
They've got a ranging diet. Usually they follow a schooling-type fish. We see them eating herring, a lot of salmonids, both salmon that are up in the water column and closer to the bottom. You can see them eat pollock, cod, a number of different species.
He says there could have been a few factors as to why this particular salmon shark ended up on the end of a fishing line.
It could be driven by changes in temperature. It could be driven by changes in the distribution of the migration routes for the salmon.
Foy says the lifespan of a salmon shark is between 25 and 30 years. They get anywhere between 6 to 9 feet as mature adults. Most of their growth occurs in the first 3 to 5 years of their life.
Depending on whether it was a male or female, we tend to see most of the male salmon sharks on the western side of the North Pacific and most of the females on the eastern side of the North Pacific. There's some mixing. We believe that they mate in the Bering Sea, so it could be that that was a mature animal, which would be probably at least 5 years old, potentially mating in the Bering Sea.
Foy says besides salmon shark, there are two other main species of sharks in the Bering Sea: the dogfish and the sleeper shark. He says they are doing shark studies on the Bering Sea, where they are looking at the sharks' mating behaviors, what they feed on, and their interaction with commercial fisheries. Pleasant gave the salmon shark away to some sports fishers in the village who knew how to prepare it. Because Quinnahock residents are not familiar with eating shark, Pleasant says his father had heard from people in Togiak that when some people there ate shark, they got sick, and his father had advised him not to eat any. In Bethel, I'm Alice Criswell.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson and Alice Criswell in Bethel and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. And by Alaska Communications Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business. ACS connects companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. Go deep inside Alaska, where the unparalleled meets the unexpected. Fairbanks emanates a quality of light, energy, and warmth found nowhere else on Earth. It's the unexpected Alaska. Fairbanks, located right in your own backyard, is full of activities from the mild to the wild. Experience summer's land of a midnight sun in Fairbanks. Information about attractions, travel, accommodations, and more online at explorefairbanks.com. This message sponsored by the Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.